go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. Search The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find the second edition there, as well as the Kindle version as well. Welcome to Cognitive Rampage. I know you're taking care of you. I like to say, I hope you're taking care of you. I'm almost starting to just believe. I know you're taking care of you, right? A little bit more drive directly to it, right? A little bit more doing and believing instead of just hoping. But this podcast is going to sit you back a little bit in your seat. Maybe make you a little grateful at the end. Probably inspire you too for a little bit. I was kind enough, or he was kind enough, to allow me on his show, the Mental Health Warriors Podcast. If you look that up, subscribe to it on iTunes, etc. We cross-promoted my interview with him. I thoroughly enjoyed talking. They really let me go off. But it's a pleasure to have you on the show, Jason McKenzie, man. Welcome to TCR.
It is a pleasure to be here, brother. It's nice to be on the other side of the mic.
Yeah, I really love it myself, man. You know, interviewing people is a wonderful thing. I love that part too. And for me, it's hard for me to keep my mouth shut the whole time that I'm actually interviewing people, as we'll probably find out in this intro. But you know, when given the chance to be interviewed or ask questions about points of view, your story, etc., it's always kind of I like sitting in there because you're on the front row. Really, you can talk, not having to think about the next step, the behind the step, how to link the story, bring it back. You can really just let yourself go. And that's part of the reason too I wanted you on to come on this show, is an opportunity for you, then, like you gave me a platform on your show to simply just cognitive rampage like I did, was to come onto this show and essentially tell your story too, and inform people about what it did for you, you know, the journey for you. I know a lot about what you do on Mental Health Warriors is about sharing the real journey of what happens mm-hmm. to us, as specifically you talk about men and mental health. But please, man, if you would, maybe kind of start from the beginning, because I'd like to get a whole cap on who Jason is, right? Where you came from the childhood. That's just me, a little Freudian stuff, but just to kind of understand, right? So people can kind of shape the mind frame of Jason McKenzie as you experience what you've recently experienced and what you've overcome.
Yeah, happy to do it, brother. So jump in anytime you want. But yeah, I grew up in a pretty normal family, I guess. Two parents, you know, brother and one brother. Dad was in the military, so we moved around a fair amount. That was just part of the lifestyle then. But, you know, we were not poor, I would say, but we were lower middle class. But we had all our everything covered. And I grew up, I guess, probably as a typical kid of the 70s and 80s. You know, I wasn't really big on emotional development. My dad was dirt poor growing up. You know, I think the gift that he gave us was not being physically abusive like his father was to him. And I am only understanding now how much of a gift that really was. So I had a pretty normal upbringing. Moved into my, you know, teenage years, my 20s, met the girl of my dreams kind of thing. And really had a very clear plan for how I wanted my life to go. And it was very typical. It was nice house, nice car, pool, beautiful wife, two kids. And for me, that was basically the construct that I was striving towards. It's just that as I became more successful in my career, all the shit would get bigger. I was better pool, better vacations, but the fundamental structure of, you know, how I wanted my life to be was in place. And I wasn't I was a bully at that time, like a alpha male prick, basically. But you know,
it,
you spoke, it's kind of what the culture explains us to be, though, right? Is
sure.
Is that a lot of what our culture, it's not every culture now, or every area now, but where we're at, where we come up, how we're raised, that's part of that culture, right? Get money, get successful, check off these, check boxes, if you will, complete the list, and along the way, take no prisoners, right? That's what you see, right? No prisoners, alpha male, no one stops me, and bury everything, right? We don't get hurt. We're not afraid, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And so to me, based on the criteria that I measured success with, it seemed to be working. I was climbing the corporate ladder. I was making good money. I was flying around the world. I had all the shit that I thought I wanted. And so things were going good. And then after the birth of our second daughter, I mean, obviously with the benefit of hindsight, I can see things much more clearly now. My wife had a long history of mental health issues, bulimia, you know, just some really erratic behavior, but I mean, I just wanted things. I didn't have any frame of reference to understand what it was. I wanted things to be perfect. So much of our life was great. 98% of our relationship was great. And, you know, she was a high achieving person too. She was a police officer, which here in Canada, police officers are really highly respected, well-paid job. I know it's not like that everywhere in the world, but it is in Canada. And so things were going great. And after the birth of our second daughter, man, everything just went to the shitter. Like, almost overnight, like she started getting angry and erratic and spending all kinds of money and drinking and, you know, hiding booze all over the house and not sleeping and disappearing and just, you know, vicious anger. And I mean, I'm looking at this going, what the fuck just happened here? My entire life has now fallen apart. She spent $20,000 in like 2 months, for example.
Wow. You know, was there anything medically they could find, like a biological link, hormonal link to anything about maybe, you know, having a child and it did something? Was it that quick, like right after the birth?
It was. Well, so it had, things had started happening even before the birth of our first daughter. So I think the wheels really came off. So she wasn't, I mean, our daughter was born in March and she didn't really seek medical help till probably the next January, I think. So, but I mean, at that Christmas, she physically collapsed. She had to be taken to the hospital in an ambulance. And she wasn't sleeping. She had organized the house into chaos. She had lost like 30% of her body weight, just completely out of control. So we went to the doctor and she had become paranoid and hallucinating. And I mean, it was, you know, and also for me, I mean, turning everything around. So all the things that were happening was my fault. Right. So to me, I no longer understood what reality was. This woman looked like my wife. She talked like my wife, sounded like my wife, but everything that came out of her mouth and everything she did was completely out of character for the woman that I had fallen in love with and been with for probably 14 years at that point.
Oh,
and 13 years. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, so we'll go to the doctor and the doctor, our family doctor says, this looks like it might be bipolar disorder. And so she referred us to a psychiatrist. So to me, you know, we go to a psychiatrist now and my belief of what a psychiatrist was basically formed from watching Frasier in the 90s, right? Which was you go to Niles Crane, you lay on his couch, you talk about some shit and then you get fixed, man. You move on with your life. And so obviously that's not the case, as I'm sure most of your audience knows. But so we went in, we met with him for 30 minutes. He went through the behaviors, the symptoms she was exhibiting, and diagnosed her as bipolar and then started prescribing medication. And I, but 30 minutes. And at the time, the town we lived in didn't have a psychiatrist. So he came 15 minutes a month. That was it. So now to me though, I'm going to tell you, man, at that time, I was relieved as hell because.
Well, you knew, right? It gives you that. Now we know.
Now we know it's bipolar and it can be, to me, it's like, it's got a name. We can devise a plan. We can execute the plan and then we'll get our life back on track, man. Well, I was naive. Was I ever naive?
Health was that easy, right? Easy that we could say, this is it. Now we know. And it feels that way though, right? When you have the diagnosis, it gives almost that comfort, I guess, in the beginning for those around you, right? That because we can say, like you said, we can organize now. We know how to treat it. We know how to come at it. And essentially, that's what a lot of mental health disorder diagnosis are anyway, is really kind of a theoretical idea of a grouping of behaviors that possibly we can narrow. So we think we know a theoretical way to treat it.
You're absolutely right. So, you know, obviously nothing worked because I know now and we'll get into this, I'm sure. But I know now that was, she was never even bipolar. There's no fucking way she was bipolar, but I didn't figure that out till this year. So
how did you handle all this, brother? Like, how did you, I mean, what kind of time span are we talking? A year, 3 years over a period of this? I mean, you said that it was 4.5 years.
4.5 years of chaos.
Oh my God. And how are you dealing with it? What was your coping mechanism, if you will? I mean, if Frasier was your only reference to basically mental health, how are you taking care of you during that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I wasn't, because the way I looked at it, so I had no tools to understand emotionally what was happening to me. So when I would exhibit like this, as I said, this chaos went on for 4.5 years about it was, I mean, and during that time we're talking homeless shelters, electroshock therapy, rehab, near bankruptcy a number of times, moving out and leaving me with our baby daughters for 5 months, like to a town 3 hours away, like on and on and on. So as I am trying to cope with this, I mean, day by day sounds like a cliche, but literally that's it. There was no point in thinking till tomorrow because I just didn't know how I was going to get through today a lot of the times. So I handled it by drinking because I didn't have the emotional self-awareness, I guess you could say, to recognize what the fuck was happening to me. Like, I started having anxiety attacks. I started breaking down. I started blurting out my life story to random strangers. And to me, man, all of that was symptomatic of the fact that I was falling apart. Mm-hmm. Right. So I had to get my shit together because I had two daughters to raise. I had a wife to keep alive. I had a job to keep, and I had and myself to try to keep sane. So I started drinking. And actually, it seemed, you know, in the way I looked at it, it seemed to work, right? Because I felt less fear and anxiety and sadness and all that when I was drunk. Now, obviously, it was a fucking disastrous move for me because it haunted me for 10 years. And
well, the truth of what you said is that working with a lot of people in addiction, it's alcohol does work for a little bit. That's the thing. It does numb you out. It kind of makes you a little bit braver, if you will, mentally. You kind of drop inhibitions. And that's the issue, is it does work. And when having myself gone through anxiety, when you feel that fear of anxiety all the time, you don't know where it comes from, especially when you think that, you know, I'm not the guy who's going to deal with it. You know, any release, even if it's 10 minutes, even if it's 5 minutes, any release away from that feeling is wonderful. But obviously, once the alcohol starts, it's not long before it's too much to keep that feeling, to go further. And not to mention it, I would call it the worst drug. It affects what, every organ in your body at the same time, the quickest with withdrawal symptoms. It's terrible, and it's legal and free all over the country.
Absolutely it is. And I think another benefit I found from it is if I drank myself to the point where I pretty much passed out, I didn't have nightmares. And I used to have a lot of nightmares, man, during that time. And so fast forward, I mean, obviously she's getting this treatment. Nothing works. There's various times when she's on 4 to 5 powerful psychiatric medications, Wellbutrin, Seroquel, lithium. I can't even remember them all, you know, and then sleeping pills and blah, blah, blah. And she's a zombie. So she keeps going through these cycles of mania and depression and just soul crushing depression, man. Like,
sorry to interrupt you, man, but part of a lot of people don't really understand what mania really is. And tons of people actually self-diagnose and cast diagnose like, oh, they must be bipolar, et cetera. And they don't really understand. And mania is a serious separation between just being excited or not being able to talk or sit down and be quiet. Right. If you don't have to, but maybe a couple things that happened with her that were mania that could really help people separate. Like, look, this is not mania. This is mania. So, you know, to help with this self-diagnosing of people being this.
Yeah. And you make a good point, because bipolar is this word that's thrown around, and it's just, you know, I'm happy one day and sad the next. And I think the paradigm that it's often described in is depression is down and mania is up. And mania is not up. Mania is almost in her case, it was disassociation from reality. So incredible delusions of grandeur, massively risky behavior, sexual, like tons of infidelity, you know, popping all kinds of pills, not sleeping for days, just screaming it, you know, making horrible, horrible decisions, spending us like into bankruptcy and not even seeing it, like believing that the reason that we don't have any money is because I had stashed the money in offshore bank accounts, you know, like, just, and meanwhile, the house is full of garbage and stuff and, you know, like that she had bought, or organizing the house into complete chaos. So it looked like it was just like a, it was just a disaster all the time. And then basically going and going and going and going till she physically collapsed because she didn't sleep, listening to the same record for days and days and days nonstop. And just basically pushing, you know, take good friends of hers coming onto their husbands in their house. Like this was a regular pattern, you know? And so all her friends are gone. Her finances are devastated. Her family's fallen apart. And you know, that's what mania is absolutely out of control.
Wow. Thank you for, you know, relaying some of the personal things there, because a lot, you're right. A lot of people just see it as this, I'm happy and then I'm sad. I'm happy, then I'm sad. And it's a complete misconception of the actual spectrum of what mania really means. And my gosh, man, just describing what that must have felt like being on the other side of that. I thank you for being revealing so people can go, I'm not bipolar. Okay, I'm sad and a little. Now there are spectrums, but but mania is that clear separator. So I appreciate you taking the time from the story there to say that.
Oh yeah, it's my pleasure. And I think too, another thing to think about is that as the recipient, as the spouse, what she would do in these and the rage, like it's hard to describe the white hot rage. Like it was just vicious. And but what would happen is she would take like things that had a kernel of truth. Like it might be like, I left the toilet seat up, for example, and that would turn into a 2-hour, you know, raging episode about how, you know, I was responsible for everything that was wrong with her life. But the problem is there is a kernel of truth to the original thing sometimes. So I'm looking at this going, God, maybe I am a total asshole. Like and you start to lose all perspective of yourself and your life. And I think the other thing that's really, it is amazing how fast you forget what normal is when normal's gone. Like how quickly you adapt to a different normal. Like we had this nice life, everything was, you know, in place and it was gone. And I honestly sometimes couldn't even see how bad things were because I lost my ability to compare it to anything because I was just in the, you know, neck deep and up to my eyeballs in this disaster. So that went on for, again, the next like 4.5 years. And ultimately we separated near the end of her life, and it was just, she threw me out of the house actually is what happened. And,
you for 4 years, man, to deal with everything you've explained, man, even the infidelity to the mental health issues, to go through all that, man, and put 4 years in, man, that's some time in, that's some warrior stuff in before really, deciding to say, hey, this isn't going to be healthy for me if we continue.
Yeah. And, you know, but let's not, I want to be very clear that I in no way come across as some type of hero here, because I made, you know, I think another thing that, and this is why I started Mental Health Warriors, especially, but I made a lot of fucking mistakes, man. And I did some really bad stuff. I mean, I remember waking up face down, in a hotel room, you know, completely hungover, realizing I had been unfaithful to her the night before, but she was locked up in a psychiatric institution at that time. And I'll tell you, man, waking up and looking at myself in the mirror that day was one of the lowest points in my life, because I thought, who have I become? You know, like, I said horrible things to her in just anger and frustration. And so it has a devastating effect that way, where it takes you so far away from the person that you want to be. And I own my actions. I'm not trying to absolve myself of responsibility, but man, when you are pushed so far beyond your limit, fuck, you make some, you know, drinking and you combine that into it. And I was taking drugs at the time, trying to, you know, with her a lot of times, because it kind of was one of those things that bound us together. Like, you know, she would take all kinds of drugs, right, like, you know, smoking dope all the time and doing blow and all this stuff. And I did it with her, you know, not nearly as much, but so I couldn't even see what was becoming, like what was happening to me, you know. And it's honestly, sometimes it's taken me till this moment now to realize it. So that goes on, and ultimately we had separated. And then in March 2010, she ended up taking her own life. So she had lost, I mean, at that point she had lost her friends. She was never going to be able to go to work as a police officer again. We had separated. The kids were always with me. Pretty much always with me. So she lost her, you know, she wasn't close to her family. And I mean, the pain was so intense. And And I like to think, and I'm not really sure if it's true or not, but I believe, knowing her for as long as I did, that the last gift that she had to give, she had nothing left, nothing at all. And I think the last gift she had to give us was the chance to build, start another life, right? So on March 26, 2010, she suffocated herself on the exhaust fumes of her car. And then that began another journey, man. Like, you know, like to me at that time, it's amazing how lacking in self-awareness I was, you know, because to me at that time it was like, okay, she's dead. It's time to move on. I need to close that chapter of my life and move on. So that's what I thought I did. I remarried, you know, this woman to an amazing woman who's become the mother of our daughters. And it's just, it, you know, but I kept drinking. I kept drinking every single day. And I rationalized it by saying, look, fuck, man, I've been through hell. First of all, there's no one in the world who can tell me that I'm not a hero. Okay. I raised these kids through hell. I tried to keep her alive. I've rebuilt my family. I've got a good job. I'm fit, blah, blah, blah. And so fuck off. Basically, if you don't want me to, if you are going to judge me for drinking, you have not walked in my shoes. Okay. And so then, but that continued and I was stagnant and bitter. And I wasn't a bad person. I was an involved father, but in my head, I wasn't living anywhere near the life that I could have been living. So ultimately in 2014, actually it was almost 3 years ago to the day, my 9-year-old daughter, my wife had started to become a little bit more insistent about my drinking, I would say, and not from a place of judgment, but from a place of you can be more than what you are right now, you know, and I was just resisting that. And who are you to, you know, it was just pathetic. And I can remember actually sitting in her office while she was saying this to me and listening to myself. This is probably about 2 weeks before I stopped drinking, listening to myself rationalize what I was doing, rationalizing the worry and angst I was causing her, rationalizing the stagnancy of my life, rationalizing the drinking every day, a lot every day is okay. And I remember listening, it wasn't like an out of body experience, but it was like, I was able to hear my voice, the sound of my voice for whatever reason, from kind of an objective point of view. And I remember thinking, you sound like a crazy person, man. Like you listen to what you are saying right now. But that was not enough to get me to stop drinking. And ultimately what happened was my daughter was 9 at the time, my younger daughter, and I had planned this really, you know, daddy daughter day. My wife and her older daughter were going to go somewhere. I don't remember where. And so I planned this day with my daughter. She was super pumped up about it. I told her I was going to make her feel special, and I just got shit faced the entire day. She played by herself, and I hated myself while I was doing this actually. And at the end of the day, she came up to me and looked me in the face and told me she was disappointed in me. And,
good for her.
Absolutely, man. She changed my life. And so that was it. That, you know, because the one thing I clung on to with a death grip was that I was a great dad. And great dads don't have their 9-year-old daughter walk up to them and their, you know, walk up to their drunk ass and say that to them. So for me,
I'm going to defend you a little bit, man, because in a way of survival, sometimes in order to get through what you went through, we have to shape that hero story. Sometimes we have to create that narrative as we're marching through that journey of chaos, and in order to survive. And for me, it's whatever it takes to survive, you know, whatever gets you through it. I can't relate to the suicide issue, but I only speak for myself. But through the abuse I went through as a kid, I had to, the way I presented myself in public was I came off as arrogant or conceited. And inside, I'm just going, look, I just don't want to fucking kill myself. Okay, so I'm just pushing forward, trying to be what society tells me I'm supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. That's why I would tell you, just eat, you know, yourself. It's okay, I think, to shape whatever narrative we need to survive what it is we are experiencing.
No, that's a great point. And I mean, I'm able to look back on it much more compassionately now. I see all of that now, but at the time I couldn't see that at all. And sure. So anyways, but in that moment, for whatever reason, she said the right thing to me at the right time. And I went downstairs, passed out, and it sounds ridiculous, like it's out of a movie, but I sat upright in bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, I feel like I'm done drinking. I think I might be done drinking, which based on history, it was completely unwarranted for me to believe that that might be true. Anyways, but I've never touched a drop of alcohol since, and I never have wanted to. And that has just, created an entirely new life for me. Like it's unbelievable. And so it's really allowed me to, you know, give me the time and space. I ended up grieving Cindy, my first wife's death, 5 years after she died. I never even knew grief was a thing that I had to go through. I actually thought grief was something that weak people did while strong people took care of the things that needed to get taken care of.
Well, that still could have been a belief you shaped in that time of survival of saying, I need this belief to be able to survive what I'm through. But to have that awareness, though, right, to be able to question yourself at that moment and look back on and go, what am I saying? Listen to the irrationalities and be able to, you know, question that belief to make that change.
Yeah, absolutely. So and what's so interesting about it is that as I went through this grieving process, so I started.
Well, man, I'm sorry. It hit me. You're sparking me, man. The idea of purging is what I basically call it or describe it as. And so many people deal with, whether it's divorce, loss of someone, all of the above, loss of job, pick it. And our society, right, says get it done, right? You have to just get through it. And so many people, in order, I think, to get through it, just concrete that it either didn't happen or it's fine or it's no big deal. And they never purge that. They never grieve through it. They never work through those processes. And so many times that builds up to such anger for self, the world around you. And the fact that you realize that, you know, I never dealt with that. I never really dealt with it. I just, pushed through it really instead of dealt with it was, for me, I could see was a huge point for you, in the change in your life.
Yeah, sure. And I think you're right, man. I think because we're taught from a very early age that our job is to be producers. We almost are raised believing we're units of economic production. Sometimes I feel like, and not human beings, you know? And so that you're right. I didn't have time to do that because I had shit to do. Right. So, but when I finally allowed myself to go through it and I didn't understand what was happening to me at the time, like I started thinking about her a lot 5 years later. And, you know, I started doing things like I rode my bike, was 120 miles back and forth to her grave. And in my head, it was July, it was very hot. And I remember thinking in her life, she felt like her family who had abandoned her and sexually abused her and all this terrible stuff, they felt like nobody had ever fought for her. Nobody had ever struggled for her that they had just cast her off. So in my grief, I wanted to do this bike ride because I wanted her to understand that I thought she was worth fighting for, which might sound incredibly strange to somebody who is hearing this, but it made so much sense to me at the time. So, which is all that really matters, right? But I mean, but that was grief, you know? And so I remember talking to my wife saying, do you find it weird that I'm like, I started writing about her a lot. And I said, do you find it strange that I'm writing so much about my dead ex-wife? And she's the one who put the word grief to it. She said, of course not. This is, you have to heal. This is grief. But what that allowed me to do is to totally rewrite the stories I was telling myself about the past. So I stopped talking about it as like this dark, tragic period of my life. And obviously there was tragic aspects to it, but I started rethinking about it in the sense that, wow, this was like a crucible experience that made me the human being I am today. And it's also a massive opportunity for me to make a positive contribution to the world. And I'll tell you, the difference in those two stories is huge in how empowered and liberated I felt.
Yeah, most people don't recognize the narrative we tell. I know so many people that have experienced difficult trials in their lives, and you see 20, 30, 40 years later, it's the same story, right? You sit down to chat with them and it's the same narrative, or they even tell you, oh, same old, you know, up and down, still dealing with this crazy relationship, right? Still trying to quit this or trying to write that narrative that we tell ourselves is so powerful. And I mean, you mentioned a few things that I definitely believe in is, you know, the idea that all that matters is what works for you, what your belief is what's going to influence that. And how you tell the story, you know, Patricia Baugh was just on the podcast last, once episode 169, and had a unusual childhood, if you will. But the way that most people would hear the story would probably crush them. It'd be difficult for them to do what she went through. But the way she told it was very much of that angle. I managed to get through that. It empowered me. It didn't become a cancer. And so many are not willing to start where you did, Jason, and be willing to go, right? What is my belief? Why am I here? And being able to go and question all of those narratives and all of those beliefs, and especially, brother, the ones that pulled you through that chaotic time, you know, to be able to say that those skills don't work anymore, that's difficult to do, especially when they work at the most chaotic time of your life.
No, you're right. And it really took me so long to understand all that. And I think that's something that's really important for people to understand too, is that there is no playbook here, right? Everybody's journey is unique. So for me, the timing happened in the time frame that it needed to happen in. And for me, what was a big part getting over, I think the big narrative to get over was the hero narrative and being able to say, I'm just a guy and I did my best. And sometimes my best was awesome. And sometimes my best pretty much sucked. You know, to be able to admit that. And I remember standing one time, it was about 2.5 years ago, I guess. And I think I'm going to start telling that story I just told you about the infidelity story about myself. And I remember the first time I decided to say it was in front of 300 cops while I was giving a talk on mental health. And the reaction, I got a standing ovation. And the reaction I got from people afterwards was unbelievable. And it just was so supportive of just me being honest and open and, you know, compassionate and kind and thankful for, giving people, we've all made mistakes, right? So just giving a voice to that. And it really, there was a light bulb that went on in my head at that time, which was, this is powerful. I'm done hiding in the shadows here. And I know now that this story has the powerful ability to help other people in some way. I'm not sure how, but I'm going to start telling it. And it's rearranged my entire worldview. So it's amazing.
Would you talk a little bit about the link of how, when you sat up that day, that night at 2 a.m. or that morning, if you will, and said, no more drinking, along with the questioning of self, the hero narrative, right? Being able to pull that back, kind of the link between those forms of beliefs and actually things that you did, behaviors that you changed, things you added to your life, et cetera, things that helped you from that very critical moment when you said, okay, I'm not going to drink again. Those beliefs and kind of link them to actual applications, things you did in your life that really began that change.
That's a great question. Yeah. So what happened at the beginning was I stopped drinking, you know, and I'm going along like I'm a week, I'm 2 weeks, I'm 3 weeks, and I'm having zero desire to drink. And I am literally, man, on cloud nine. Like I'm thinking, holy shit. Because I had tried and failed to quit drinking a million times. And so I'm walking around and I'm going, if I manage to quit drinking, I can do anything. Absolutely anything. Like it was like an entire new world was opened up to me, except I didn't do anything differently other than I had stopped drinking. So I'm saying this, oh my God, I can do anything. Okay. After a few months, I can do anything apparently, but I'm not doing anything different. Right. Mm. So what's up with that? So, and then I started questioning myself like, oh shit, maybe this is actually the height of my capabilities. Right. This is maybe I was already as good as I'm going to get. And now I just have to go through life not drinking, you know? So then what I did was I heard this, just everything happens for a reason. And I heard this completely random podcast, from Hal Elrod about the miracle morning. And I thought, well, you know, I get up really early anyway. So what I was doing at the time was I was getting up, always waking up at like 4:30. And then I would read all this shit about politics and all this stuff that I actually couldn't care less about now. But at the time I did. And I would start my day angry, right? And so I thought, I heard about this morning routine. I thought, well, I'm just going to try this morning routine. And I mean, what else? I might as well. And It made me feel differently immediately. And what was cool about it was it made me look, I was always a very direct cause and effect person. If I take an action, I want to be able to quantify the result, assess the result and determine, you know, very like data oriented that way. This taught me that. So I started doing this morning routine and I started going to work and I started looking at I was walking into work in a different frame of mind. I was looking at people differently and I was seeing opportunities that I wasn't seeing before. So then throughout that summer, I mean, I ended up riding my bike, 5,000 miles that year, something crazy like that, 5,500 miles. You know, my emotional health got better. I started blogging all the time. I started a website called From Drunk to Monk that was kind of chronicling my journey. I started to connect with more people online and started to talk more openly about my story. And it was like, holy, this is a whole different type of life here. Like, and I'm only at the beginning, the very beginning stages of it, but the morning routine was a huge part of it. And then what the next part I think was really understanding as I started to feel better, I started to, and more positive and look at the future more positively, I started becoming more aware of the negative influences in my life, right? People, my Facebook feed, you know, like all of that kind of crap. And I started just, I didn't definitively like axe people from my life, but I just drifted, I gravitated towards a different kind of people. And I started to meet new people and I started to read personal development books and listen to personal development podcasts. And it was like just exposure to an entirely different world. And then I started to get feedback from people. Like, you know, I started telling my people my story at work. And then I was a pretty senior leader at the company I was at. And then people started coming into my office, closing the door and telling me stuff. Like I had a woman come in, tell me, very highly capable professional woman, break down and say, I was a prostitute all through my 20s. Oh. Anybody this, you know, and other like just things like that continued to happen. And I started to have this idea that, holy moly, like I can make a huge positive contribution here. And that was a really hard thing for me to wrap my head around. Like, who am I to make that, to think that I could make that contribution? I now know that we all have the power to make that kind of contribution, but it was a hard thing to accept that this guy who was had this crazy story and this battle of booze. Now I have just with my sharing my story and, you know, having an open heart and mind, can make a huge impact on people's lives. Right. I guess those are some of the things I started doing.
That's a cognitive rampage, brother.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I talk about with the Tribe of Change too. When I try to talk people into doing videos or sharing, et cetera, going live, is that vulnerability that comes out when you become vulnerable like that. It's weird how it becomes almost armor in a way. It's, I know it's backwards, right? But when you're shedding that almost, you're opening up and being able to share. And I tell so many people that everyone's story can influence and help somebody. Now I also say that no one really changes anybody. That person has to decide and make those differences and make those changes in their lives. But even if you can tell a story where someone goes, yeah, I was similar to that. I experienced that. And maybe this is a way. And, you know, I'd say, look, if somersaults work, do that. It doesn't matter what works for you. But for you, you were making small adjustments and then adding to those, then assessing those along the way that affected you, that helped your change. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize the power of the social connection. I think so many people don't realize it's understated. I think Dr. Gabor Mate talks about it, but that social connection, and especially when we isolate, when we're drinking, when we're depressed, these are ways where we disconnect socially. And for you, even though it's online, it doesn't matter. For me, if it saves somebody's fucking life, how can we bitch about or say that virtual connection isn't real or this isn't real? It doesn't matter to me, and especially the person at the moment, right? And when you let your story out, how many people it started kind of surprised me in a little bit. Then I kind of like, well, I guess not. How many people really are going, I just need to talk to somebody. I just need to say this. I need to put this out there. And sometimes they get attacked, right? They get told that, oh, you're just trying to make money on a story, or you're looking for validation or sympathy. And truthfully, the person's like, no, I'm really just need to say this to someone.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, vulnerability. So it's funny. I can remember riding my bike home that summer thinking, what is this thing? And I heard a Tim Ferriss podcast with Brene Brown. And that's the first time she put the word vulnerability to it. So I got really fascinated by this subject. And I ended up writing a book about it. But I kind of defined it as having the courage to look yourself in the mirror and be honest and without judgment about who you see staring back at you. Because I think that self-acceptance and self-love, there is no greater armor. Man, like nobody can hurt you if you love yourself, right? And that gives you the courage to put yourself out there and share your story. And I also believe that when you share your story, warts and all, you create a place of safety for other people to share theirs. I mean, and ultimately that's what we all want. We all want to be accepted for who we really truly are, you know? And so, yeah, I could not agree more. And I feel like you talk about human connection. Like everything I do right now, like, so mental health warriors, that's what my main focus in life right now. But it's ultimately all about creating a different creating a forum for human connection, because that's, you know, and that's really what so many people do, whether it's around fatherhood or whatever. It can be, the subject's almost irrelevant. It's human connection. And I never, ever realized, and it's crazy to think about, I think about all the adults that I have talked to in my entire life, thousands of adults, no one ever told me this, the power of creating connections around real shit with your fellow human beings is the antidote to so much of what ails us, man.
Yeah, I like how you said real shit, because, you know, sharing and being vulnerable and open about our hardest parts of life, right? Not just our easiest parts. That's where we connect. I think that's how we kind of go, like the guy, the lady who came into your office, right, and mm-hmm. opened up like that. All of a sudden, there's this, whoa, we're vulnerable here, you know, I'm with you, right? And we connect, and we kind of said, well, all right, well, if you're willing to drop that, I'll drop this. But we're taught not to share that part of the story. It's changing a little bit, the paradigm, but mm-hmm. For the most part, it's fake it till you make it, right? We all go through it, pull your bootstraps up, right? Get through it on your own and push through. And this is isolation even, right? We're just taking that approach toward it. And, you know, I can't help but when I heard your story as you're walking through that to think, I think our daughters are similar ages, or mine's a little older, I think.
Mine are 13 and 12.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So mine's 17, and I couldn't help but think about some of her past, right? What she may have witnessed in her early life before I adopted her, and your daughter, right? About that experience and how much of what you thought about her, what you realized. And I do want to throw you a compliment here too, before I ask you the question about your book is, you probably have already seen the silver lining in it anyway, but it's inevitable that our children will face difficult times at one point or another in their lives, whether that's inwardly, right, or coming from a external environment or an external influence. But what you showed her through that, man, was that you can go through some of the worst things on earth and still pick yourself back up. Had you not experienced that, had she not gone through that, she would never have gotten that lesson. She would never gotten that lesson. And that also provided an opportunity for you to show a chance that that's not a lesson you can self-create in a family. And you were able to show that. And the fact that you came through it and are still, you know, reaching out to others and influencing others, that has such a powerful effect on the children that actually go through those type of traumatic events, but can really grow from it. Because when they face it, they're going to go, "Dad faced it. And I saw what he did, and it is possible."
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, it also created an opportunity for me to drive home a very powerful lesson to her, which was last year on the 2-year anniversary of being sober. I was actually driving with her to pick up some figure skates for her. And I pulled the car over and I said, "You know, I know you probably don't remember this moment." Of course, she didn't remember the "I'm disappointed in you" moment. But I said, "You know, you having the courage at 9 years old to be honest with me in that moment gave me the courage to be honest with myself. And you at 9 years old changed the trajectory of your 41-year-old dad's life. So you think I want you to, first of all, I will forever be grateful to you for doing that. But I want you to understand how much power you have to change people's lives. Think about that." And, you know, it was funny on that day, the day I told her I was going to make her feel really special, and then it got completely shit-faced. After I told her this and I told her how thankful I was and I told her all that, she looked at me and she goes, "You just made me feel really special, Daddy." So it was just beautiful.
Man,
like,
you got me all verklempt, man. My eyes got all watery. Talk amongst yourselves. Talk amongst yourselves.
It was super powerful. But yeah, you know.
That'll get you, man.
What a lesson, right? But, you know, it's funny talking about vulnerability, because I think at a very extreme example, my first wife was a perfect example of what happens when you aren't able to be open and honest about what's happened to you and what you're going through. Because in her life, you know, I didn't find out this till the very end of her life, but she experienced horrific sexual abuse and physical abuse and abandonment. Her mother was schizophrenic and all of this stuff. And she ran from those demons her whole life. Oh. And they caught up with her. And that's why I didn't understand, truthfully, and we've talked about this on the podcast, when you were on the podcast, I did not understand how that trauma impacted her life until this year, when I sat down with somebody else we've had on the podcast, Sabrina Andrews, who told me about emotionally driven responses versus mental illness. And she goes, basically, I walked out of there going, this whole fucking thing I believed for so long about her being bipolar. She was not bipolar. She was hurt. She was fucking hurt bad, man. You know, and whether it was post-complex, post-traumatic stress or borderline personality disorder, she never healed and dealt with the trauma that she experienced, and it haunted her to her death. But when she went to the traditional medical system, she was given this fucking label. And it's just, so the grief thing is crazy because now so here's what goes through my head. You know, 7 years later, I realized there's no way she was bipolar. There's no way. And I think, God, she could still be alive. She could easily still be alive. But then what goes through my head is, oh my God, I don't want her to be alive because I've got this family now. And then I feel terribly guilty for even having that thought in my head. It's not that I don't want her to be alive, but these are just the very quick thoughts that go through your head. And it's this weirdest, the human brain, or, you know, we go through life, we're not really prepared to process the shit, right? Like, you know, she's dead. She could have been alive. I've got this life now. What would that mean? I mean, I've been dreaming about her more. Like, it's this never ending journey, right? But, yeah. So just to, I don't really know what to say about it.
No, you're talking real here. I mean, it's not, she didn't commit suicide until she was diagnosed. Let's just say that. Yeah. Now, whether it's causation and causality, we don't know, but whether it's the pills that she was taking that were psychotropic in nature that then trip wires enough to go that far, which we all know they warn you about, and the mixing, and most of them, they use this with this and add this, which isn't even made for this, but it does this. I mean, I worked in it. I asked questions when they would say, yeah, this drug doesn't really go with this drug, but because you're taking this drug, we need this one to counteract that one. It does this amazing thing sometimes when it counteracts with this. When you start messing with the wiring like that of someone that's already struggling, it gets so dangerous. And for you all, we're again talking about Mattei's theory with trauma theory and the idea of never really dealing with that trauma, and this trauma manifests, man, and it festers and becomes a cancer. And when you can't purge, she obviously didn't purge. She didn't tell people enough about it, didn't work through it. And it becomes easier, I think, to just say it's been 30 minutes and you match this criteria. Here's your label. Here's your pills. Thanks for coming in. See you next week. When truthfully dealing with that hurt, as you talked about, that deep embedded hurt, that abandonment, probably did a number on the self-esteem, on the self-worth and personal value.
Oh, absolutely. And I can't imagine, bro. Yeah. Well, you know, and I talked to so many people, and I'm sure you do too, who beat themselves up about what they are experiencing right now. I have feelings of failure. I'm not good enough. I have anxiety. I feel depression. And they just don't make the connection between what happened to them when, you know, like in their past, right? And they don't see this thread that runs through their whole life. They just look at right now, I am not fucking conforming to the way society says that I should be. I'm not measuring up to everybody I see around me and the facade that they put up. Therefore, I'm a fucking loser, right? And whenever I talk to these guys, I'm like so compassionate. I'm like, okay, man, like just fuck, be gentle with yourself here. And let's talk about it. Every time I say, tell me about something, tell me about your past. It's like, blah, you know, it's like, yep. Okay. So I'm not a professional, like I'm not a therapist, but I know enough to say there's probably a connection between, you know, then and now, right? Are you willing to consider that?
Yeah. Well, so many people, we went through an era of, that's kind of why I wrote that book. My book is bringing all those sciences and theories and theoretical approaches together is, people went through an era, if you will, of mental health to where it was labeled as Freudian, right? Having a influence of your childhood, right? And it became too Freudian. The cognitive practitioners came out about, you know, being in the now, changing the thoughts. All this also is powerful and works. Mm-hmm. But we tended to then let go. We became more about the behavior in the present. We came more about modifying it with changing the behaviors in the present and the thoughts. And this is very powerful. But we can't ignore that we're an evolutionary, influential, biological thing that changes, that is influenced from so many things in our lives, and our childhood being those of the most developmental. I mean, the fact that this is where we learn our routine. This is where you learn about what a bird is, what a person says, how you respond to fear and anger. These, you experience those so-called emotions, if you will, as an early child. And that is the influence. That is the set foundation. and how we move into our adulthood, we bring those tools with us because that those become so traumatic because it's the first traumas we face. It's our first enemies that we face, our first demons, if you will, that get created. And however we beat those or battle those or cope with those or ignore those, we use those same tools as adulthood and we build the same life that was around us when we were children and say, well, my tools work. We're right here, man. And, oh, man, I'm going off, brother. But I did want to, oh, God, you just get me going, man. And I hate to get on the same tangents that I talk about. But the Freudian influence that what you've been through has a fucking influence on you, what you watched your mom do, how you watched them be a couple, how you watched them raise you. This all is influential. And to ignore that and say, no, I'm tough. This is society's standard. I ignore this. I am man. I am woman. And I'm going to make it, period. It works for a little bit, but you run that shit on red line. And eventually it comes crashing down.
Oh, absolutely. And so I haven't found... I didn't learn any of this until this year, right? So, and it's shocking to me. And so one of the ways that I feel like I can honor Cindy's legacy is by trying to do anything that I can to make sure that nobody else has to go through this, right? To run from their past and, you know, be afraid to connect authentically with people because of fear of judgment and, you know, the shame they feel, and to be able to let people go and show them that there's fucking tons of people that will accept you just as you are. You know, you don't have to be perfect. We're none of us are perfect. We've all had a million things happen to us in our lives. We've made a million decisions. Some of them are fucking awesome. And some of the decisions we make are so fucked up that they, you know, that we wish we could take them back. And that's part of the human condition. So to be able to just share, like, I want people to see that. And so every time that I hear a story where somebody tells me, oh my God, like, you know, that episode of the podcast or, you know, somebody said something to me in the group or whatever, I just feel this, like, I don't know. It's almost like, I don't know how to frantic, like this frantic sense of urgency to say, I need everybody to hear this. You know what I mean? It's, I'm sure you know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, you know, shout it from the mountaintops. There's another way. You are loved. I will accept you, you know, like, or whatever the message is. It just gets this burning flame just gets hotter and hotter and hotter all the time, man.
Yeah, that's definitely a cognitive rampage, brother. I mean, that, well, I want to lead into the podcast, too. I mean, this is what you're out to do, right? Is to share stories of those that are in it, have been through it. What's one of the ones, that maybe stuck out to you early in creating your podcast, some of the early people you interviewed or something that, one that really threw you back or something?
Oh man. So actually it was so the podcast is, they're all early in the podcast because we started it like 2.5 months ago, but I interviewed a guy on Friday and listen to this. So he was sexually abused by his mother. You know, tons of physical abuse by his father, just a horrific childhood. So he becomes in his early teens anorexic because anorexia, obviously controlling his food intake. It was basically the only thing in his life he had any control over. He becomes anorexic to the point where they have to hospitalize him. He goes to the hospital. What do? They do two things. They try to make him eat. They never talk to him about the trauma that he's been through in his life. So you got the ladies in the cafeteria going, yeah, you got to have more mashed potatoes. You're so skinny or whatever. And he's not allowed to leave until he finishes his plate. So what does he do? He becomes bulimic. Because bulimic gives you the appearance of being able to be normal, right? So he becomes bulimic. Man. And then he manifests these relationships all through, like, you know, just shit relationships. He screws them all up through his whole life. Obviously, he's had trauma. He has no idea how a healthy relationship works. And he gets to the point, his mom, who abused him and was a drug addict, overdoses in his 20s. And he has a breakdown. Then he gets labeled as bipolar. And he gets put on all these medications and blah, blah, blah. Make a long story short, he now realizes. So he actually listened to that podcast episode, that lady I was telling you about, emotionally driven responses versus mental illness. And he goes, he has finally said, I'm not bipolar. I know I'm not bipolar. And with the love and support of his wife, he's changed his diet to, like, he's a vegan or vegetarian. And he knows that I went from crawling to walking But I know my path forward now. And it just blew my mind, man. Like just not only to think of where he is now, but what happened to him? And then how he's re-victimized over and over and over again by these people that are supposed to be helping him. Man, crazy.
Well, it's not like you hear many people get the diagnosis and go, bullshit, doc. Right? They jump into it. They start WebMD-ing it, right? They dive all the way into it as fast as they can. And almost because a mental health diagnosis feels a lot like something you don't have control over, because essentially a lot of the help that's offered for it can be very subjective to the person, right? It's theoretical in nature. Like you said, a morning routine for you was the beginning of a change, where someone else can be like, I tried 85 morning routines and I'm still here, right? So it may be your afternoon routine, right? It could be something else. It's so open to interpretation, application. So you rarely hear someone say, you know, I'm not that. And yeah, that too, I don't know. I think when I first heard you say it about the guy here listening, my first response was like, fuck yeah. You know, I was like, good for him. Mm-hmm. And I still got to be careful, because some people, they take the diagnosis and they treat it one way and it can help them, right? And it does apply to them.
Sure.
But the way it's applied, in my opinion, everyone knows I disagree with, 30 minutes, here's your diagnosis, good luck, doesn't work. But the idea of real investigation, real observation, that kind of thing, you can get there. But for someone to really say that that's not, and he's actually turned the life around by changing all the other aspects, yeah, man, I mean, that's what I wrote the book on, is the other way to do it. And there's no real one way, essentially, man. That's that would be a good one. Now, I do want to ask you I cut you off there. You had something to add?
Well, I was going to say too, like, I think too, ultimately, even as difficult as it is, we are all accountable for our own lives, right? So when you are in a terrible spot, like I think of Cindy, right? And I think, man, like nobody could have helped her really, because she was not willing to be open about her past. I didn't find out about we were together for 16 years and I didn't find out about these things that happened to her until the very end of her life. Like, she just finally broke down and said to me a lot, but it was too late at that point. And
it's too late.
Yeah.
Holy shit. So I feel bad, man, for, you know, sitting there 16 years cooped up like that, man.
Yeah.
And inside.
Yeah. And I mean, really cooped up for entire life. And
yeah, yeah.
But ultimately, she's the only one who had the power to help herself. She could have gotten assistance from people if she had been, but that's like the, I don't know, the vicious, you know, I don't know how to describe it.
Well, it's a real stigma, man, because, you know, I do want to kind of ask you about that. Actually, there may be people watching or listening, you know, that have experienced a spouse or a friend or a sibling or family member commit suicide. And mm-hmm. I've talked to a few actually that have been involved over my time, but they always feel a sense of guilt, right? As if they could have done something. I could have helped or changed. And I generally greet that with going, well, it's highly arrogant of you to think that it was you that was going to save her or him or anybody else. And we wear that guilt. It's very hard not to wear that guilt when you're really attached to that person, right? When they're significant in your life, et cetera, even friends that wear that guilt that maybe if I could have done something. And I heard you say that there's no one, and I would agree with you, that can save themselves but themselves. And what was your journey like through that belief, through the belief of I could have saved her, should have saved her, and wait a minute, that's no one's job but hers at the moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so for me, what happened was at the time I felt zero guilt because I knew that I had done everything that I could. But then what happened, now I will say what I did, I did feel guilt about what the moment I found out that she was dead. The cops came in my house and it was like 12 o'clock. Midnight on a Friday night and sat me down on the couch and said, she's dead. One thing I felt guilt about was the first thought. Here's the thoughts that went through my head are, oh my God, how am I going to tell the kids? Number two, holy fuck, I'm so relieved. I had this massive feeling of relief that her pain was over and that I was going to have the chance to build a new life. And then I felt massive guilt for feeling relief in that moment. But as far as guilt about not being able to that I could have done more, I did not feel that right away because I knew at that time, man, I gave everything I had. However, as time went on and I started talking about it, the story started to change to one where I was becoming more critical of myself, because what I wanted to do was I wanted to show people that, yeah, I mean, I screwed up a lot, man, during that time, because I wanted to bring comfort to the other people that might be going through that. But then I started to focus on that, and I started to convince myself that I was worse than I actually was. Right. And then just this year, actually, I remembered that during that time I had gotten a lawyer to try to protect myself, and I had taken like 100 pages of notes, and I remembered that I had sent this to the lawyer. So I just emailed her and I said, "Hey, do you still have that thing, that document?" And she sent it back to me, and I read through it. And boy, was that ever an eye-opening moment where I could become much more compassionate with myself, right? Because I read it. It's like the women say the pain of childbirth goes away. We want to heal. We forget what pain is like. When I went back and I reread that document, it made me so much more compassionate, because I had forgotten what it was like every day, all day long, to be involved in a world that was so bizarre, so toxic, so angry, so frightening. You know, I just forgot. So when I went back and I read that, and I was transported right back in that moment. But I'm done with the guilt. You know, like I don't feel that. I know I gave everything I had, and in some ways it was enough, and in some ways it wasn't. But it was what I had to give.
Yeah, I think slowing some people down too, that maybe have a simple response to what your feelings were not. You know, for me, I think about her kids. I think about them, you know. So the idea of, if you were that person experiencing what, you know, Jason here was experiencing, and you had been through this 4 or 5 year battle like that, who someone obviously was not really looking for help, et cetera, and was really dealing with some things. No, I don't want to take any of that away. God, I mean, my heart goes out to that, but I'm only speaking to that moment of where you did feel the relief of how that can actually come from the protection of the children, to where you can kind of respond to that going, they're now no longer going to be exposed to that anymore.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because, you know, they were young, they were 6 and had just turned 5. And so they didn't really know what was happening, because they were with me most of the time. Kids at that age get very used to their situation quite quickly, you know.
Best adapters on the planet, and they will adapt it, as we said, in childhood, then apply it in adulthood.
Absolutely. So, but yeah, I didn't know how I was going to, you know, quote, protect them from that much longer. You know, they were, I mean, they're 12 and 13 now. There's no way I could, you know, pretend that things like that I could hide it from them at this age. Right. So there was a huge
many of them know. Many parents think they don't know. And they really know. They've been around in the hallway. They were listening on the phone, or they heard a friend over at the house. Them little ones know more than most parents really actually think they do.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe sometimes I think that telling myself I was protecting them from them was really a mechanism of protecting myself more than anything else, right?
No, but even at the – but, dude, that's the response, though. That is what people do, is go, let me shelter them from that, keep them from that. And even if it's 2 or 3, if you will, mental bullets coming through or experiences, that's saving, because it takes just one experience to impact them traumatically, as we know with your ex-wife. So, you know, any – moment that you prevented is helping them. Any one less moment of experiencing that is definitely helping them.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, as this experience gave me a whole different foundation on which to build a new life, new insights and, you know, self-awareness and all that stuff, it's allowed me to help my kids see that too. Right. Because I'm open with them about when I feel sad, when I feel the grief that I've gone through, like, you know, they know what that's like. They know what it was like for me to, I just really emotionally open with them and connected with them. So, because I know that if they know that they feel that their dad feels the same emotions that they feel, they'll come to me when they feel them. Right. But I never would have had any of this self-awareness if I hadn't gone through this experience. So, and I also think that for our family now, my kids might not consciously be aware of this, but they have I believe an increased sense of gratitude in what we have now, because they know at some level that they had that, they lost it, and then they got it back again, you know, or a different version of it back again. And so I wouldn't say that they would be able to verbalize what that means to them at this point in their life, but I think they just know how that they're, you know, you know, unlucky in some ways, but, you know, lucky in other ways, right? So it's, my, I guess my point is, it's made parenting them as teenagers a lot easier than it might have been otherwise.
Dude, I agree with you. I'm 100% with being open with your children about your life and what you experience, right? Now, there's a lot of professionals that would say, look, we don't want to share every, you know, everything. You know, we don't want to pull out every nook and cranny of every nasty automatic thought we may have or thing we may have done. I'm not saying you lay that on them all the time and make them your therapist. But when you are vulnerable, again, with your children, we talked earlier about vulnerability being connection. And you can apply that in the workplace with friends, with partners, relationships, wives, especially with your children. But so many parents think they have to walk around like a fucking superhero. Like they have to walk around going, I have all the fucking answers. I know what you should and shouldn't do forever. Meanwhile, they're laying in their bed at night going, what the fuck am I doing with my life? But if their child asks them what's up, the first thing they do is go, you need to do A, B, and C, and then I know because I've been there. But, I mean, I've been open with my daughter ever since, hey, I'm a human being, and I tend not to judge her choices, right? We talk about her choices. We talk about, I mean, she told me just this weekend we were hanging out, right? She said some amazing things to me where it hit me in my life, and I was like, holy shit. And I'm looking at her like, wow, that's good. And I look at her, I said, man, I had something to do with this, right? I helped raise some of this. She goes, no, I determine my own beliefs and values.
Right on.
I'm like, son of a, she got me, man. You know, and you hear that. And I think that does come from going, when I've talked to her about when I was sad or worried or fearful, you know, they may hate the book or this may be terrible. I'm worried about this. And then she does when she's scared about a friend thing or an action. She's quick to, you know, if I ask now, they're not very quick to volunteer. And that's where parents can't get twisted. You know, you have to ask and inquire, and they like that you're inquiring. And I'm just going to use some slang here. When you respect their gangster too, when you respect that they're a human being too, when you show that kind of respect, you really get it back instead of demanding it by force and Gestapo like shoving your beliefs down their throats.
Oh man, you just hit the nail on the head, man. And I couldn't agree more. Like, so I look at my job as a parent fundamentally, other than, you know, the providing shelter and safety and all that. I think my job as a parent is to teach the kids their incredible power their choices have to shape their future. So if I look at, you know, yes, I'm not suggesting people barf every mistake and innermost feeling with their kids. But what I'm saying is use your life to help them make more informed choices. So if you look at drinking, for example, I never tell my kids not to drink, but I say, listen, okay, here's my experience, right? Like, here's why I took my first drink at 13, because I lacked self-confidence and I just wanted to fit in and blah, blah, blah. And here's why I drank when mommy was sick, right? And here's the thought process. Here's what it did to me. And, you know, here's what I was setting myself up for, which I didn't realize. But here's what my life is like after I stopped drinking, you know, and just give them the picture and give them the information in an open, honest way. I've told them about how guilty I felt sometimes, not the specific mistakes I've made, but just that I felt guilty or feelings of shame or that, you know, when I was a teenager, yeah, man, drinking was fun. Like, Jesus, come on, you know, getting with your buddies and doing stupid stuff as a teenager, it was fun. But I didn't see what I was setting myself up for down the road. But giving them the information and then saying, you are a sovereign human being. You will make your own choices. Your choices will have all our choices have consequences, all of them, right? But that's what I see my role as a parent. And they are so self-aware. And will they drink? Yeah, I'm sure they'll drink at some point. Every teenager does, you know, but I am really confident that they will make, if they do decide to make that choice, they'll make it from a position of strength and self-awareness. And they will not allow themselves to be like bullied or pressured into it like I was, right? So that's really what it is. Give them the information, be vulnerable enough to give them the real information from your own life and teach them the power their choices have to shape their future. That's what a parent is supposed to do in my books.
That's another cognitive rant. That's a parent cognitive rampage. Is that kind of what the book was about, the book that you wrote?
Yeah, it is. So, you know, so as I'm going through this idea of vulnerability and I'm learning about it, I'm realizing, God, my relationship with my kids is getting better, but also my relationship with everybody is getting better. And so I thought, I got to write a book about this. And not too many people are talking about the men vulnerability space. And what I wanted guys to see was it's not weakness. It's strength, courage, and wisdom, whether it's as a man, a husband, a father, or a leader, like a leader in your community, a leader in your family, a leader at work, right? So, and so I really, I had, It's funny when you start, I'm sure you went through this. I started writing this book. I'm like, I don't know any, like, how am I going to write a book about this? You know, I got this publisher who gave me a publishing agreement and, you know, and again, it was, as you said, it was a wonderful opportunity too, to talk to my kids, right? Because it's like, I shared with them the process. Like, I don't think I'm even going to be able to finish this. I think I'm afraid it might be crap, you know, and this whole bit. And then, but that's what the book is about. I want guys to understand exactly what we were just talking about, that being a lone warrior on the hill is not the best way. And to raise kids that are emotionally astute and developed and self-aware and want to live a life of service and understand how much power they have to have a positive impact. That's not how you do it. You know, you do it by letting your guard down. And, you know, I always say, when you lay down your shield, you become invincible, right? And that's what I wanted guys to see, was just a different slant on what it means to be a man.
Oh, I love that approach, man, is showing them to be vulnerable. There's so many single moms, dads, even families that really just keep it in the circle. They just, they don't deal with anything outside of the circle. Maybe an aunt or a grandma adds to it, something. But they try to keep this tight-knit, safe face thing going on and don't reach out for help when there's so many resources now for help, you know, between your podcast, a friend of mine doing the Dad's Formation Project, and Andrew Maranti, trying to bring that to the awareness of others, to say, hey, you can reach out to other fathers, right? You can reach out to other mothers, etc. And when you do that, you open up the social circles of your own kids at the same time, and immerse them in that and show them that when they go through it, because indirectly, as a dad or a mother, single or not, or family, what you may be teaching them is just that, is to go, when you have an issue, don't talk to anybody about it but us. And good luck if you've done a perfect job making sure your daughter or son is going to come to you with everything that they deal with. So about teaching them that, hey, you may indirectly teach them that don't reach out for help. Keep it in the circle. Keep it to yourself. Talk to me about it, or mom, or somebody, right? But at least just keep it here, when the truth is, hell, talk to your English teacher, you know, talk to your coach, talk to your friend, please talk to somebody. And when we do that and model that as parents from a vulnerability perspective, as well as a social connection perspective, and being open about that, man, that is how I think you really build a larger team and teach those. I love that idea of the book. What's the name of the book? Where can everybody get it, et cetera?
So the book is called The Dadly Book of Open: How Cultivating Vulnerability Makes You a Stronger, Wiser, and More Courageous Father. And it's available on Amazon, all the regular places.
Beautiful, man. I think you and I, we've talked before on your podcast a little bit. We end up going off about a couple subjects and go forever, man. But
yeah, for sure.
Got to wrap it up here a little bit. You've dropped a gang of cognitive rampages. I appreciate you practicing what you preach in vulnerability and sharing, even on the spot moments, things I know you maybe hadn't thought about sharing, and really doing what you say, and giving people the courage really to say, hey man, this guy's sharing it. He said it, I'm going to say it, and put that on the forefront, man. And, I applaud you for the change, the effort you put in, the father that you've been, the one that you've become and will continue to grow into. And I look forward to hearing more of the Mental Health Podcast, Mental Health Warriors Podcast. I love the angle, obviously. I'm biased, but I love the angle. There's so many people out there that, you know, don't deal with it in a proper way. They don't they're not even aware of it, or they have to just deny it. They got an ostrich in the sand about it. And so anybody that's sharing their story, and much less trying to get others to share their story and giving platforms, man, is certainly a mental health warrior in my book, man.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, it's funny because that's really what's become clear to me over the past little bit, is I've given a lot of talks to people about this subject. And I always felt like these talks, you know, in front of an audience were transactional, in the sense that I never knew what happened afterwards. And so I started telling myself, I'm so sick of talking about this, you know, like I'm just reliving the past, and I'm not sure if it's making a difference. And I just had this epiphany that, like, maybe in May, I thought, you know what? I'm not actually sick of talking about it. I'm sick of only talking about it. And so that's when I thought, you know what? Fuck it. I have to do more. So I started the Mental Health Warriors community and the podcast, and it's just been amazing. And it's just, I feel like I'm walking the talk, and I'm actually taking action. I'm taking action like I'm always telling other people to take action, right? So it feels good. And, you know, it's one of the things that allowed me to cross paths with you, man. So there's just, you know, there's all kinds of benefits that come out of it, and I'm never going to stop. So
Well, we appreciate it. And all those that, all the lives that you'll affect and inspire as you continue your podcast and those you already have and bring on your show, man. I appreciate it. Just let everybody know the website, where they can find the podcast, et cetera. Maybe even throw them a preview, what you got coming up.
Yeah. So the, website is mentalhealthwarriors.com. You can reach me at jason@mentalhealthwarriors.com. You can find the podcast on iTunes. So just like every other podcast, really. And what's coming up? Well, we got leadership. So I'm going to do a theme of leadership month coming up. So I have the former commissioner of Canada's largest police force coming on, talking about his own mental health issues. I've got people talking about New York Times bestselling authors. So we're going to start doing some themes around some really interesting subjects, I think. But right, it's funny. I don't know if you've gone through this, but right now I'm just I have so many podcasts in the bag. Like I'm like 5 months ahead now, right? And I'm like, what am I going to do with all this stuff? I just can't stop talking to people. You know,
well, drop them all, man. Forget the one a week thing, man. Drop 2-3 a week. That's what I did when I came out. I would do one and drop it. Do one and drop it.
I think
and
I'm going to.
Next thing I know, I'm at almost 200 episodes, man. And just do that. Forget the whole, well, it's Monday at 8. We're going to drop it. I mean, nobody watches some shit like that anymore on TV. Nobody, you know,
right.
It may come on Sunday or Netflix, dude. Just, and the fact is, with so much content, that's what people want. So the fact that somebody's got 7-8 shows to listen to and you got 200 in the bank, that means if I want to binge watch on Mental Health Warriors, I can't binge listen. I can only go so far, man. So if you're at this mode, keep dropping them, man. Drop 2, 3, 4, 5 a week.
Done. That's what I'm going to do.
You do it. Kill it, man. And you'll keep dropping more. That'll just bring more attention, more content, more people getting reached individually. It'll grow a lot faster to the show and, you know, and share it on the Tribe of Change too. I encourage everyone that's doing their own work from the tribe to share it. So
share the show
there like you do. But yeah, we're, you know, TCR is behind you, brother. I'm standing in arms with you, man, on the mental health warrior front, brother.
Thank you so much, man. It's, you know what? I'm so glad we crossed paths. It's been an honor to be on your show, man. And I'm so glad you came on mine.
All right. Well, the honor's all ours, bro. And thank you for sharing. Keep doing what you're doing, man. And well, I'm sure we'll link up again in the future, man. You're welcome anytime on the show.
Okay. Thanks, man. Same to you.
Okay, brother. Take care, man.